Morning, everyone, and welcome to the Beacon Group's Noon Step Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Sunny, and I am an alcoholic. In an effort to lessen distractions to others and to respect our speakers, you will not be able to unmute yourself while our speaker is sharing. Let's start this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. But we ask that only alcoholics participate. If you are new to AA or new to the Beacon Group, we strongly recommend home group membership and sponsorship. If you are new or not so new and looking for a sponsor, please put your name and number in the chat. If you have worked all 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, have had a spiritual experience, awakening, and are willing to sponsor, please also put your name and number in the chat. The chat will remain open during the meeting except while the speaker is sharing. Also in the chat, you will find your AA quote of the day. The quote source will always be from AA literature. Our speaker will share for 30 minutes on the step of the day, which I will time. Then we will split into great breakout rooms for small group discussions. Each group has a moderator who will divide the time equally and invite each person to share. Questions are encouraged during the sharing part of the meeting. When you share, please be sure your environment is quiet and free of distractions. Breakout room discussions end at 12:54, followed by day counts, announcements, and the Lord's Prayer. And I've asked Jolaine to read the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Thank you, Sunny. My name is Jolaine. I'm an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you so much, Jolaine. So today we will hear a talk on step one. Step one, as we just heard, is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. Please give a warm welcome to Cliff G. from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Take it away, Cliff.
Thanks, Sunny. Hey, everybody. I'm Cliff Gooding. I'm a grateful alcoholic. sober since August the 15th of 2001. And for that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. It's good to be back here. I want to thank Sherry for inviting me. Thank you, Sherry. Had I known this was this group, I might have said pass because I was just here like 2 or 3 months ago. I didn't want them to get sick of Oklahoma. So there we go. But I'm grateful to be here, and I'm really glad to be sober today. And, you know, step one seems to be so appropriate today because it seems to me that the whole world has gone crazy today. I just know that. I got to start out this morning early with the call from a guy that I sponsor and a kid that he sponsors. And alcoholism is, you know, when the book talks about we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. We ought to slide in there. We deal with ego, cunning, baffling, and powerful, because it seems to me that once you get here, that seems to be the number one nemesis when you're here for a bit. And I just got off the phone with a kid just before I jumped on here. And he was, you know, what I'm listening to is all the insanity of alcoholism, all the things that go along with that person on the left side of step one, that idea that, you know, this is what I need to do. This is what I should do. This is what I'm going to do. And the conversation was, look, as long as you're in charge of your own recovery, this is going to be a continuing conversation. And the question I posed to him was, how many times has this played out like this? Yet he couldn't see the inconsistencies of if they need me to come home. It's the insanity of alcoholism. And, you know, I need to have calls like that, and I need to be. I got sent to a treatment center when I was 27 years old. And all of you know that no one, my God, can be an alcoholic at 27. I mean, that's just crazy talk right there. But they sent me to a treatment center. And I want to tell you, when I went out there, they had the wrong guy because I was not then alcoholic. And I had a problem. It seemed to me. And the problem was a back problem. Everybody seemed to be on mine. They needed to get them off. So I went to treatment. So, and I sat in that treatment center for 30 days and came home. And when I came home, I just was concluding the divorce from my second ex-wife. And I got the house, but she got the neighbors, which, by the way, is never a good trade. So just let me tell you that up front. And on the first day I was back, I was in my backyard, and my neighbor to the west of me had two little boys. One of them was 8 and one of them was 5. And the little 5-year-old was in the backyard. And we got to visit, and he said, well, Cliff, where you been? And I'm trying to think, well, how do I tell this kid that I've been to treatment, you know? And so I thought, well, you know, hey, I just been away. And just straight-faced and as serious as he could be, he said, oh, my mom said you were probably in jail. And, you know, she said it more than once out loud. And so I could just tell you that story, and it'd probably tell you everything you need to know about me. But I'm going to tell you the deal about me is this, is that when our textbook when the doctor's opinion talks about restless, irritable discontentedness, and Bill Wilson wrote on step 5 in the 12 on 12, he wrote this little blurb. He said he talked about the pangs of anxious apartness. And of course, back in the big book, he talked about the bedevilments. And as long as I can remember, I have been a bedeviled person. I mean, I'm out of the chute being bedeviled. And, you know, before I ever had a drink, If I really take an honest stock of my life, if I really look at my life, you know, I have all the isms of alcoholism. I mean, I am that person from an early age, that kid that looks around and thinks, man, if I had those kids' clothes to wear, if I had been born to a different group of parents, if my parents lived in a better place, if they had a better job, I mean, I just tick down the list of why my life is the way it is. And mostly it's how I feel internally. I'm looking around taking stock and trade of everybody else. And I see that I just feel different than them. And I have no idea how I feel, how they feel. But what I do is I take a stock in their external conditions and I compare that to my internal feelings. And I'm losing every time. I mean, I just lose every time. And when I was 11 years old, my brother, under a big old weeping willow tree down in Southeast Oklahoma, he cracked open a Tall Boy Country Club malt liquor, and he took a big drink and he handed it to me. And I took a big drink, and I don't know how long it took me to drink, he and I to drink that beer underneath that big shade tree. But I can tell you this, when it was concluded, the magic of alcohol happened for me. And I say it's the magic of alcohol because that's the way our textbook describes it. It talks about the effect produced in the real alcoholic. And it talks about that effect being produced in a real alcoholic being so profound that they'll be willing to chase it into the gates of insanity or death. Not up to, into the gates of insanity or death. And I'm going to tell you, every time I drank, I'm willing to pay that price tomorrow to relieve me from the pangs of that anxious apartness, the restless, irritable discontentedness, the bedeviled feelings that I have right then, because I never fit in. I don't measure up. I'm separate from. And I'm this guy that really believes when we arrive on the shore of Alcoholics Anonymous, all the research has been done for a guy like me, that step one is simply a conclusion that I reach based upon the evidence that's been laid out before me. When I look at my life, I have to look at my life honestly. You know, that part of our textbook says we learned we had to admit, concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic. That concession, that surrender internally that I'm alcoholic. And the only way I've ever been able to do that is take an honest appraisal of what alcoholism is and look at that compared to my life. And we all know that alcoholism is this three-piece puzzle. And I've already talked to you about the piece that just haunts me, that spiritual piece that I have no clue that's what's wrong with me. I have no clue that I have this spiritual malady that the big book talks about. I like what my friend Paul says. It says, you know, on the day I was born, they should have given me a white chip and a pop-up big book. I would have just been well served by having that. I could have just, that would have been everything I needed to know about life. I could have just started from that point and gone forward. But I got this malady, and I don't know that that malady drives all the behaviors of my alcoholism. I don't know that the malady causes me to do that, what we talk about when we get over to step three, which I know is not our subject. But it's the malady that drives me to assign you roles. I mean, it's the malady when I meet you that gets me to assign you a role. And if you really love me, or if you are my friend, this is how it would look for you to love me. This is how it looks for to be my friend. This is how it looks if you're going to parent me. This is how it looks if you're my brother. And when you don't fulfill those roles, it makes me restless, irritable, and discontented again. It reaffirms everything I believe about myself, which the book talks about causes for more drinking. And I'm this endless cycle in that malady trying to make that work. I'm just trying to figure out how to fit in. And you know how I perceive myself, the perception I have of me and how I see my life is totally different from the way it is. You know, I kind of like to see myself as this Jim Morrison, Lizard King kind of, kind of guy. And really, I'm Eddie Munster, really. I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, I'm kind of Opie Taylor. I mean, I'm totally, my life is totally different than the way I perceive it. And, you know, I get that beer and everything shifts internally. The malady is quieted. And you know, the thoughts are, I need to do that again. And who wouldn't want to do that again? you know, when our book talks about the sense of ease and comfort, not real ease and comfort, but the sense of it. And I get that when I drink. It abates that malady. It makes it, well, for lack of a better word, it makes me feel what I perceive as okay. I think that I'm okay. And who doesn't want to be that? I mean, if you're restless, irritable, discontented, wanting to get rid of that's an okay deal. I mean, wanting to abate that, that's an okay deal. And so there's a couple other pieces of the puzzle that I don't know about. One of them is that when I drink, something different happens to me than 90% of the population. I mean, I don't know when I take a drink that it sets off an allergy inside of me that just makes me thirsty. You know, the delusion that I have is that I just like to party. That I don't know anything about an allergy. I don't know anything about the phenomenon of craving. I like what my buddy Steve says. I've never been in a bar and started drinking and thought, get back, that phenomenon of craving's kicking in. Y'all better step back a step, you know. I don't know what that is. I just know when I take a drink, I just like to party. I think I'm just having a good time. That allergy of the body. And, you know, I know people, and I bet the people on this screen know people that have other kind of allergies. And you may have some yourself. I mean, there are people who are lactose intolerant. They drink milk or eat ice cream and something different happens to them. You know, they get an upset stomach. Some people are allergic to strawberries. Some people are allergic to bee stings. Some people are allergic to nuts. My God, the nut people, that they're a class all to themselves. You know, people who are allergic to peanuts, they make one emergency room visit and they quit forever. I mean, they don't need to go to Peanut Anonymous, read the Peanut Big Book, or have a peanut sponsor. I mean, they swear off forever and they mean it. I mean, they don't backtrack from that. One emergency room visit. And that just boggles my mind, you know, to think about that. When they come to a restaurant, they walk in and say, has a peanut been on this city block? It's not enough to have one in the restaurant. They need to know if there's anyone in the vicinity. And I'm going to tell you, I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. And I'll give away cars, houses, families, children, jobs, career, integrity, dependability, stability. I'll give all these things away. I never connect the dots. It's the booze. I mean, I never connect the dots that when I drink, this allergic reaction kicks in and I'm off and running. See, it's them, it's him, it's her, it's it. If you had to live with the person I live with, if you had to work for the people I work with, if you came where I came from, I have a list of reasons. It's kind of like a Wheel of Fortune wheel up there. I'll just spin till it hits the right one. And I drink. And if it was just that, you know, if I just had this malady and if I just had this allergic reaction, my buddy Randy would just call me up and say, Cliff, you're allergic to alcohol, man. You can't drink because when you start, you can't stop, you know, so you can't drink anymore. Just stop drinking. And if it was just that, man, you know what I would do? I'd just quit drinking and I'd just get on with my life. And I know some people like that. I mean, when I grew up, there were people who I drank with and who partied with me that looked a lot like me. I mean, we would go toe-to-toe on the weekends. We'd go toe-to-toe on the holidays. And then the strangest thing happened to those people. They met him. They met her. They got great jobs, and they just quit. And the strangest thing about those people, when they just quit, their lives got better. I mean, objectively better. They started getting promotions at work. They started buying houses. They started having kids. And they just quit drinking. I'm going to tell you something. I'm not like my friends. If Randy would call me and just say, hey, Cliff, you're allergic to alcohol, just quit. You know what I'd say? It's a great idea. I'm going to do that. But it's the third piece of alcoholism. It's that third little piece hanging out there, which our textbook says is the whole enchilada. It's where the whole thing drives from. It's this mental obsession I have that centers in my mind. It's that piece. Because Randy could call me every week after I come off a run and say, man, you just need to quit. And I would say the same thing every week. You're right. I'm quitting today. I'm quitting today. Because I believe this is a fact, that I'm in a room today with a bunch of professional quitters. I believe that everybody in this room had probably quit hundreds of times, that you've made that with or without a solemn oath, writing it in a Bible, whatever. Groups like us, I'll make that kind of commitment that I'm done forever. And then the strangest thing happens to me. I mean, I could come home on a Thursday and my wife could be cooking dinner. And she could say something like, Cliff, we're out of bread. Dinner's going to be ready in an hour. I need you to go to the store and get some bread. And I would agree to it. I'd say, okay, I'm in. And I take off to the store to get bread. And I go in, I get the bread. And I come out, I look at my watch. I've got 50 minutes on the clock to get back to my house. And I run into Randy. And Randy says, what are you doing? I said, well, Lori's cooking dinner at home. It's going to be ready in 50 minutes. I got bread. I'm going to get home. And Randy might say something like this, 50 minutes. Well, hey, man, we could go over to the log in, have a couple of beers. You'll be home in 50 minutes. And of course, when I get that information, I filter that through the keen alcoholic mind, you know, which in AA is the only place you ever hear about the keen alcoholic mind. It's just in AA. I filter that through there and I think 50 minutes, two drinks, I can do that. And so on a Thursday night, Randy and I go to the log in to have two beers. Sunday, when I get home, everybody's mad at me. She's mad, kid's mad, dog, cat, everybody's mad at me. And I don't know why. I got the bread, right? And I gather them all up. I start telling the story. And I tell them the story all the way through. And when I get to the spot where I ran into Randy, something in my head flips. And it says this to me. There's the problem. Randy's the problem. If he had run into Randy, you'd been home. And I begin to tell the rest of the story from the perspective that Randy's the problem. And when I get done with that story, I do what I'm willing to gather that everybody in this room has done on succession and succession and succession. I look in the eyes of the people that I love the most. Parents, wives, children, employers, friends, down the list. And with or without a solemn oath, but I promise, I swear, I commit, I whatever, I'll never do it again. Solemn oath. And next day I get up and go to work. I go through traffic. I get downtown. I get to start thinking about how they don't really appreciate me at work. I mean, I'm down here busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day, killing it at work, man. And they just don't really appreciate me down here. I get about all that going on in my head. Go back home in the afternoon, go through traffic. And somewhere in there, this thought begins to creep into my head. I don't know why they're mad at me. I apologized yesterday. And when that thought starts to creep into my head, I got a couple hours, maybe on a good stretch, 12 or 24, really good stretch, 36 hours. But somewhere in there, what's going to happen to me is I'm going to find myself back at a bar or two drinks in, or better yet, not even remembering how I started. As Bill would say, pounding on the bar, saying, how did this happen again? And I've repeated that process over and over and over. And that mental piece, that mental obsession is not only the one that confounds a person like me, but it makes the people in my life who've never taken a drink or who never have been around anybody like me scratch their head, wonder what is wrong with him. And that spiritual, that physical, and that mental peace, I got that. I mean, I absolutely have that. It's this idea that I can't drink and I can't not drink. And I'm going to tell you, when I wash up on the shores of Alcoholics Anonymous, what our textbook describes in the chapter, We Agnostics, beaten into a state of reasonless. Because I really believe the only really time you have an opportunity to talk to an alcoholic where they'll absolutely listen is when they're in a spot. Because if I'm not in a spot, you really don't have any really good information for me. It's nothing you can really tell me that's going to resonate with me. But when I washed up on the shores of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had an old man who had been consistent with me every day coming and asking me, how are you doing? How are you doing? And I would give him the same answer. Fine. I'm fine. And he would just look at me and say, well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know. And I ripped off 45 days in AA just not drinking, figuring out I'm not like my friends because I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker sitting right in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, when I just don't drink and go to meetings, my life doesn't get better. I'm not like my friends. I get worse. And the reason for that is when I washed up in Alcoholics Anonymous in the summer of 2001, I had 41 years of restless, irritable discontentedness every day. Every day, the four horsemen would show up at my bed and we just ride all day together. And I don't know about you, but alcoholism never really shows up at 3 in the afternoon. It's always 3 in the morning. Cliff, get up. We got a lot of things going on. We've been up for an hour getting the game with us, man. And we're up and we're going. And the head's got a lot of stuff to talk to me about. None of it really relevant, but they got a lot of things they need to impart to me. And so I'm in the game with them. And it's that cycle over and over and over again. So when I washed up on the shores of Alcoholics Anonymous and made it 45 days and I just was at a spot that I just went and drank because I can't just not drink. If you eliminate alcohol from my life, I'm going to jump out this window on the 12th floor of this building I'm in. I'm drinking. That's just it. I don't know how to live out there in this vehicle and not abate the restless, irritable discontentedness. I got to do something. And I know booze works for that. And I did that. And I washed back up on August the 15th of 01. And old Don caught me one more time. And the day I walked out of that meeting, after running out of that meeting, he caught me and said, "How are you doing?" And on that day, I gave him a different answer. And I said, "I'm not doing good." To which he responded, "I know." And he said, "Well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know." And I said, "I need a sponsor." And that was not what I was thinking. What I was thinking is there's nothing you can do to help me. But out of my mouth came, "I need a sponsor." And we talk about it a lot in AA. We kick it around about incomprehensible demoralization. That's what our textbook talks about. We talk about the gift of desperation. Might be all of that. Probably is. But for me, it's just grace. Just grace. It was a moment of grace where I was in a spot. And what happened was one of God's messengers crawled through the window of grace before my self-will could pull it down one more time. I think the worst thing that could happen to an alcoholic is get the feeling better early on. And we get the feeling better. We get the second thing back, our opinions. You know, we get our opinions back. You know, I can come here real desperate. I can come here just, I'll do anything. We need to go to 20 Alcoholics Anonymous meetings a week. I'm in. I can move into sober living. I can get there and say, what's the rules here? And I can comply to all those. But you get me about 30 days away from a drink and I'm not doing anything else. Now I've got a girlfriend. I'm working out more. Those 20 meetings a week, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's just insane. And I start coming up with all kinds of opinions about my life. And I'm grateful on that day when I was in that spot and Don crawled through the window and he began to talk to me about the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. He shared that experience, strength, and hope. And he talked to me not from a moral high top. He's a guy that carried a message of depth and weight. And when he began to talk to me, you know, I just pushed all my AA chips, imaginary chips, to the middle of the table. And I went all in on AA. When that book talks about we learned, Don talked to me about that. I think one of the most important things that he talked to me about was really looking at that crack between I'll never do this again, I swear to God, I'll never do it again, and picking up the drink. And in that crack, seeing the insanity of my own thinking, in that crack, looking at what happens to me between I'll never do it again and the first drink. In there lies the insanity of alcoholism. In there lies the peculiar mental twist. And I had to look at that. He had to help me see that. He had to help me see this allergic reaction that when I started, the delusion of that I like to party, it had to be smashed because I'm not like other people. And he helped me do that. And the way he helped me do that, he helped me look at the evidence in my life. And I bought into the physical allergy. I believe that was me. I believe I've got that. When I drink, there's no predictability about when I'm going to stop. And when I'm not drinking, I have no predictability about when I'm going to start again. I can't drink and I can't not drink. And somewhere in there, that old man got through there and he brought me a message of hope. And I'm going to say this to you and I'm going to shut up. Step one, everybody says, and it's a fact, that the only step I have to ever take 100% is step one. And I'm a diehard believer in that. I'm 100% believer in that. But I'm going to say this to you all. Step one, without the rest of the steps, becomes just another bad day in my life. If I don't follow up with the rest of my life, with what's really going on, if I don't follow up with the steps, it's just another bad day in my life. So I want to thank Sherry for having me. I'm grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. It's good to see all my friends here today. Thank you.